Okay, so diving in today, we're looking at, it's a pretty complex part of scripture that actually you sent our way. It's Paul's discussion on, men and women and their roles in public worship, specifically 1 Corinthians 11:2 to 16.
Yeah, this section, it really is a bit of a minefield, isn't it? I mean, there's so much debate surrounding it, you
Oh,
know.
absolutely. Tons of different opinions and interpretations.
And it's understandable why. We're talking about how we understand worship, gender, even the impact of culture on faith.
Right. Huge topics.
Right.
It's rich, but as you said, can be pretty overwhelming if you're trying to make sense of it all.
It can be a lot.
It's exactly why we wanted to tackle it.
Yeah.
So you passed along Dr. Gary Meder's lecture,
Yeah.
and our goal in this deep dive is to sort of break it down, the key arguments, the historical context,
Yeah.
all that good stuff he lays out.
Yeah, good plan.
Think of it as like a roadmap through the main points so you can grasp the different interpretations without getting, totally bogged down.
Right, a shortcut.
Exactly. So you're looking for a way to navigate this passage without getting lost. Well, let's see what we can unpack together, shall we?
Sounds good. Now, to really start this off right, we have to remember what Paul was actually dealing with here. He wasn't like writing some kind of timeless theological essay. It was way more specific than that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. He was responding to real, practical questions and even potential issues that were popping up in the Corinthian church, specifically in their public worship gatherings, what Dr. Meders calls the assembly.
Okay, the assembly. So it's like right there in the thick of things, practical stuff.
Exactly, practical stuff. And the main thing causing a stir, it seems to be head coverings.
Head
Head
coverings.
coverings. Specifically, whether men should have them on when they prayed or prophesied. And then, what about women? Should they be covered or uncovered during those same activities? All within the church setting, of course.
Okay, so right away we're talking about these very visible symbols and
Yeah.
I guess what they meant.
Absolutely. Now, with the men, let's look at verse 4. Paul says that a man who prays or prophesies with his head covered, well, he's dishonoring his head.
That's pretty strong language. Why would that be such a big deal back then?
Well, think about the world Paul and the Corinthians were living in. They were surrounded by Roman culture.
I'm completely immersed in it. Dr. Meder's really emphasized that point.
And in Roman religion, get this, it was totally normal for men to cover their heads during worship.
Oh, really? So the opposite of what Paul's saying here.
Exactly the opposite. So Paul isn't just talking about personal preference. This was a direct clash with what was going on around them.
Gotcha. So there's like a cultural layer to this already.
Big time. And that's where this idea of syncretism comes in. You know, the mixing of different religious ideas and practices.
Right. Blending things together.
Exactly. So if Christian men started doing this very Roman thing, covering their heads during Christian worship, well, it could make those two things look a little too similar, you know? Blur the lines.
I see. Yeah, that could definitely create some confusion.
And Paul wouldn't want that. But there's another layer here, right? It's not just about avoiding cultural confusion.
What else is there?
Paul throws in a theological reason, too. He says that man is the glory of Christ.
Okay. The glory of Christ.
Meaning, in the specific context of worship, if a man's head is covered, it's like he's hiding that connection, obscuring that reflection of Christ.
Oh, I see. Yeah, like a symbolic barrier or something.
That's the idea. So we've got the cultural concern and this theological point working together.
Okay, so that's the man. Now, what about the women? Verse 5.
Right, verse 5. Here, Paul flips the script. He says that if a woman prays or prophesies without something on her head, she's the one dishonoring her head. He even compares it to having her head shaved, which was a huge mark of shame back then.
Wow. Okay, that's a pretty striking image.
It is, and it really emphasizes the seriousness of this issue, at least for Paul.
So what exactly are we talking about with this covering? Is it like a full-on veil, like in some cultures today?
That's where it gets interesting. Dr. Meders is careful to point out that based on the language, it's not necessarily a face veil. More likely, it was some kind of head covering, like a cloth or wrap.
Okay, head covering. But he also mentioned something about the actual Greek word used.
Yeah, this is really key. The Greek word we usually associate with a traditional veil, like a separate piece of fabric, that word isn't actually used in this passage.
So it's less specific than that.
It is. The language is more about being uncovered or having something down the head, which opens up the possibilities a bit.
Okay, interesting. So Maybe not a fixed specific item, but more about the concept of covering in general.
Exactly. And that brings us back to Roman culture, especially the expectations around married women.
Right, because Dr. Mitters talked about how Roman women would often wear a head covering when they were out and about.
All the time. And he even suggests that the toga itself, which was like this big piece of cloth, they might have just draped it over their heads as a kind of covering.
Interesting. Like a multi-purpose garment.
Multi-purpose, yeah. And he brings up this ancient writer, Plutarch.
Plutarch.
Yeah, and his advice to new brides, which talks about a wedding ceremony and uses a similar phrase, kata kalupatai, to describe a covering, signifying the woman's new status as married.
Okay, so there's definitely a link to marriage here.
Oh, absolutely. A head covering was a very clear symbol that a woman was married.
Not just a fashion choice then, but tied to social roles and expectations.
Definitely not just fashion. And it wasn't just a minor custom either. Dr. Mitters mentions Auster, another scholar, who found that Roman women wore head coverings in religious settings, too.
So it had both social and religious significance.
Exactly. And all of this feeds into Winter's fascinating proposal about these new Roman women.
New Roman women.
Yeah, he suggests that some women, especially the elite ones, were kind of pushing back against traditional roles.
Oh, interesting. Like a feminist movement in ancient Rome.
Kind of, yeah. They were doing things like, get this, participating in wrestling matches. All sorts of things that challenge the expectations of how women should behave.
Wow, that's, yeah, pretty bold for that time period.
It was. And one of the ways they signaled this rebellion was by choosing not to cover their heads.
Ah, so a very visible rejection of the norm.
Very visible. Now imagine if Christian women in Corinth were also showing up to church uncovered.
Yeah, they could definitely cause some friction, both within the church and with the wider Roman community.
Absolutely. It raises all sorts of questions about how the early church balanced its own identity with the surrounding culture.
Right. Like, how much do you adapt? How much do you stand out? How do you avoid causing unnecessary offense?
Exactly. It's tricky stuff. And it's all tied up in this head covering business. Now, let's circle back to that phrase we mentioned earlier, down the head, in verses 4 and 5.
Yeah, down the head. Dr. Mitters made a point about that, didn't he?
He did. He pointed out that the actual Greek phrase, kata kephales, doesn't necessarily mean, like, long flowing hair cascading down.
Oh, really?
Nope. He actually uses Plutarch again as an example. Plutarch uses the same phrase to just mean something on the head, period.
So it's more general than that.
It is. It's not about a specific hairstyle, but about whether the head is covered or uncovered.
Gotcha. So, once again, we have to be careful about reading our modern assumptions into the text.
Right. Language changes over time. We have to understand how those words were used back then.
Okay. So keeping all this cultural and linguistic stuff in mind, what are some of the reasons why there might have been this controversy in Corinth?
Well, Dr. Mitters suggests a couple of key possibilities. One is that you had these newly converted Roman men, maybe even higher status ones, coming into the church, and they were used to covering their heads during Roman religious practices. So they might have just carried that habit over into Christian worship without even thinking about it.
Right, just what they were used to.
Exactly. And that could have looked a lot like syncretism, which, as we talked about, was a concern for Paul.
Makes sense. Blending those lines between Christianity and the surrounding culture.
Right. And the second possibility is that some women were coming to the assemblies without head coverings. And that would have gone against the typical Roman social customs for married women. Maybe it was influenced by those new Roman women we talked about.
The ones who were pushing boundaries.
Yeah, or maybe it was just a general loosening of social norms. But either way, it would have raised eyebrows, both within the church and in the wider community.
Yeah, like, what are they doing over there?
Exactly. It could have even made people think the Christian women were, you know, adulteresses or prostitutes, because that's how uncovered married women were sometimes perceived in Roman society.
Wow. Okay, so those are some pretty weighty implications.
Yeah, pretty weighty. It all goes to show how these seemingly simple acts, like covering your head or not, could carry huge cultural and social meaning.
Absolutely. So we've got the issue. We've got the cultural backdrop. Now let's dive into the theological reasoning that Paul lays out, specifically in verses 7 through 10, where he talks about glory and image.
Right. This is where it gets really deep. So Paul starts by saying that man is the image and glory of God, and because of that, he shouldn't cover his head in worship.
Okay. Image and glory of God. What does that mean exactly?
It's a way of saying that man, in this specific context, represents God in a unique way. And if he covers his head, it's like he's obscuring that image, hiding that glory.
Okay, so direct connection, a reflection of God's presence.
Right. And then he says that woman is the glory of man.
The glory of man. And that leads to her covering her head.
That's one way to understand it. Dr. Metters explains that if man reflects God's glory and woman reflects man's glory, then her covering during worship could be a way of directing all the attention to God alone.
Right, like a chain of reflection, and the head covering ensures the focus stays where it should be.
Exactly. It's about keeping the emphasis on God, not on any human being, even if they're considered glorious in this context.
I see. And Dr. Metters is very careful to point out that this isn't necessarily a blanket statement about gender hierarchy in every aspect of life.
Right. It's specifically talking about how men and women present themselves before God in public worship. It's not like a commentary on their roles in the family or society as a whole.
Okay, important distinction. And the whole concept of glory, doxa in Greek, that's key here, isn't it?
It is. Dr. Metters links it back to the creation story in Genesis, where God creates man and woman. He points out that they're both created in God's image, but there's also this order and relationship between them.
Right. Man is created first, then woman from his side. So there's a complementarity there.
Exactly. And Morna Hooker, who Dr. Metters mentions, offers a really helpful interpretation.
What's that?
She suggests that the man's uncovered head directly reflects God's glory, while the woman's covered head, in this specific setting of worship, kind of sets aside man's glory.
So it's not about diminishing women, but about making sure the focus stays on God.
That's the idea. Now, we get to a really tricky verse, verse 10, where Paul says a woman ought to have authority over her own head because of the angels.
Yeah, that's a tough one. And Dr. Metters pointed out that even the translation is debated, right?
Oh, big time. He highlights the literal translation, which is a woman has authority on her head.
Okay, on her head. But the Greek word there, epi, it can be ambiguous, can't it?
It can. It can mean on in terms of location, but it can also mean over in terms of control.
So two very different meanings. And that ambiguity has led to a lot of different interpretations, hasn't it?
Oh, tons. And Dr. Metters shows how this plays out in different Bible translations. Some add words like symbol or sign of authority. One even translates it as having authority over her own head.
Okay, so they're basically trying to fill in the gaps based on their own understanding.
Exactly. And Dr. Metters suggests that maybe we don't need to add all those extra words. He proposes that the authority here could refer to a woman's right to participate in worship, but only if she's aligned with the symbolic order that Paul is talking about.
And if she's covered.
Right. It's like that covering is what allows her to fully engage in worship in a way that honors God.
Okay, so it's not about men having authority over women, but about the head covering itself signifying something important.
Precisely. Now, what about that because of the angels bit?
Yeah, that's a strange one. Why bring angels into this?
Well, Dr. Metters says the most likely interpretation is that angels are seen as these cosmic observers, guardians of God's created order.
Okay, so they're watching.
They're watching, and they're making sure things are done properly, especially in worship.
Gotcha. So the woman covering her head is partly about making sure the angels aren't misled or distracted.
Right. It's about ensuring they focus on God, not on human beings, even if those humans are representing God's glory in some way.
Interesting. And there's even imagery in Revelation, isn't there? Angels cover their faces before God.
Yeah, as a sign of reverence and humility. So maybe the woman's covering is kind of mirroring that heavenly protocol.
Okay, so there's a cosmic element to this too. Now, after all this talk about glory and angels, Paul throws in something a little different in verses 11 and 12.
He does. He talks about how men and women aren't independent of each other.
Right, that they need each other.
He says, woman is not independent of man, nor is man independent of woman. Everything comes from God. It's a reminder that despite these specific instructions for worship, there's a fundamental equality between men and women before God.
Right, a mutual dependence.
Exactly. And then in verses 13 through 15, Paul shifts gears again. He appeals to the nature of things.
A nature of things.
Yeah, he asks this rhetorical question. Is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? And given everything he said about culture and the symbolic meaning of head coverings, the answer is probably no.
Right. Because her uncovered head would be seen as, I guess, misrepresenting man's glory in God's presence.
That's the idea. And then he uses this analogy about hair length.
Oh, yeah. Long hair for women, short hair for men.
Right. He says long hair is a disgrace for men, reflecting the cultural norms of the time, but it's a glory for women, even saying it's given to her for a covering.
Now, Dr. Metters was clear that this is an analogy, not a literal command, right?
Absolutely. He's not saying long hair is the required covering, but he's using this natural difference between men and women, their hair length, to illustrate the broader principle of covering and uncovering.
Like nature itself points to this distinction.
Exactly. And that brings us to perhaps the most debated verse of all, verse 16.
Ah, yes. The one that starts, if anyone wants to be contentious about this, and even the translation of this verse is all over the place, isn't it?
It is. Dr. Metters points out that some translations, like the NRSV, say, we have no such custom, which kind of implies some flexibility.
Like maybe it wasn't a hard and fast rule everywhere.
Right. But other translations, like the NIV, say we have no other practice, which sounds way more strict.
Like, this is the way it's done, period.
Exactly. And those two interpretations lead to very different conclusions about what Paul meant.
So is he saying the Corinthians are wrong? Or is he just acknowledging that there might be some variation in how things are done?
It's tough to say for sure. Dr. Metters brings in Judge, another scholar, who distinguishes between conventions and tradition.
Conventions versus tradition. What's the difference?
So conventions are like the specific cultural expressions of a belief. In this case, it might be the exact style of head covering, the type of fabric used, things like that.
Okay, the outward appearance.
Right. But the tradition is the underlying principle. In this case, the idea that men and women present themselves differently in worship based on the creation order.
I see. So maybe Paul is open to some flexibility in the conventions, but not on the core tradition.
That's one way to read it. And then there's Fitzmyer, another scholar, who thinks this verse is about church discipline.
Like Paul's laying down the law.
Sort of. He's saying, look, this is the established custom and you need to follow it. And the no other practice translation supports that idea.
Right, because it implies that there is a standard, a way things are done in other churches.
Exactly. So it's a really tricky verse to interpret. But one thing Dr. Metters points out is the shift in language from tradition earlier in the chapter to custom here.
That's interesting.
It might suggest a subtle shift in Paul's tone, too. Like, he's being more careful and nuanced in how he addresses this issue.
Yeah, especially compared to the strong commands he gives later in the chapter about the Lord's Supper.
Exactly. Now, taking all of this into account, what might have been the specific issue in Corinth?
Well, one possibility Dr. Metters suggests is that some Christian wives, maybe those meeting in house churches, weren't covering their heads.
Yeah, makes sense.
Maybe they were influenced by those new Roman women we talked about.
Who are pushing boundaries.
Right. Or maybe they just felt less bound by social expectations in a more private setting.
Yeah, like we're just in someone's house. It's not a big deal.
But even then, it could have caused problems, right? Either by going against Roman norms or by inadvertently aligning themselves with this more radical group of women.
Absolutely. And Dr. Metters then dives into Winter's historical research, which sheds even more light on all of this.
Okay, what does Winter say?
Well, he emphasizes that head coverings were actually pretty common in Roman society for both men and women, especially during religious rituals.
Oh, really? So it wasn't just a women's thing?
Not at all. And when Paul tells men not to cover their heads, it might be specifically to avoid imitating the Roman priests who did that during their pagan ceremonies.
Ah, so another layer of cultural sensitivity.
Right. And there's the social status angle, too. If lower status Christians started copying the head covering habits of elite Romans, it could have caused tension within the church.
Yeah, like they're trying to climb the social ladder through imitation.
Exactly. And Winter also clarifies that while the Greek word goon can mean both woman and wife, in this specific context of 1 Corinthians 11, it's most likely referring to wives specifically.
Okay, so this is really about married women in public worship.
Right. And then he brings up the new Roman wives again. Yeah. He explains that these women were really pushing the limits of what was considered acceptable behavior. And in Roman culture, seeing a married woman uncovered in public was a huge deal. It could be interpreted as adultery or prostitution.
Wow. Okay. So Paul's instruction for wives to cover their heads might be about making a very clear distinction between Christian wives and these, I guess, more scandalous women.
That's a strong possibility. Or it could just be about upholding social conventions to avoid any negative perception.
Yeah, like don't give anyone the wrong idea.
Exactly. It's fascinating to think that the head cover itself might not have started as a religious requirement for Christians, but that it became this really important cultural marker that had ethical implications.
Right, a way of navigating the complexities of Roman society while also maintaining their distinct Christian identity.
That's the key. And Dr. Metters points out that Paul uses really strong language here. He says wives ought to cover their heads. Husbands ought to have uncovered heads.
Ought to. Like, yeah. It's not a suggestion.
It's an obligation. And this ties back to that idea of maintaining a certain social order, especially in the context of marriage.
Right, because remember, the whole point of this passage is about appropriate conduct in worship.
Right. And the part about hair length in verses 14 and 15 also fits into this cultural understanding.
Yeah, because back then, hair length was a big visual marker of gender.
Huge. And Dr. Metters wraps up this section by highlighting the unique nature of early Christian gatherings. They were public, they were weekly, they were focused on communal worship, and they didn't involve idols.
Right. Very different from many Roman religious practices, which were often private or involved idols.
Exactly. So for these early Christians who were already standing out in so many ways, adhering to certain social conventions like head coverings might have been seen as really important for their stability and their witness to the wider community.
Okay. So we've covered a lot of ground here. But before we wrap up, Dr. Metters offers a really important caution about how we approach this passage today, especially in the context of modern gender debates.
Right. He basically says, don't read your 21st century ideas onto a first century text.
Good advice.
He warns against taking our modern categories of egalitarian, complementarian, or hierarchical and just slapping them onto this passage without considering the original historical and cultural context.
Right, because those categories might not even have existed back then in the same way.
Exactly. He encourages us to go back to the primary sources, read what ancient writers had to say about gender and social customs.
Like Plutarch, who we mentioned earlier.
Right. And he also suggests engaging with different scholarly perspectives on these issues. He specifically mentions the Council for Biblical Manhood and Womanhood and Christians for Biblical Equality as examples of groups that hold contrasting views.
Okay, so get a well-rounded understanding of the different interpretations out there.
Exactly. And he also recommends checking out view books on women in ministry, which can provide a more in-depth look at those different positions.
So, as we come to the end of our deep dive,
yeah,
what are some of the key takeaways from this passage?
Well, first and foremost, it's about proper conduct in public worship. Paul is really concerned with how the Corinthian church is presenting itself.
Right, both to God and to the wider Roman community.
Exactly. And he uses the symbol of head coverings to talk about deeper theological ideas, like the glory of God and man within the creation order.
And all of this is happening within a very specific cultural context, with all its social norms and expectations.
Right. The meaning of the head covering itself and the implications of that tricky verse 16,
right.
Well, those are still debated today. But by understanding the historical and cultural background, we can at least get a better grasp of what Paul might have been trying to communicate.
Absolutely. So as you reflect on all of this, what stood out to you? What parts of the cultural context or the theological arguments resonated most?
And how might understanding all of this inform how we approach worship and discussions about gender roles today? It's definitely something to think about.
Absolutely. And as Dr. Metters said, this lecture is just a starting point. There's a whole world of scholarship out there waiting to be explored.
We've mentioned a bunch of names: Plutarch, Oster, Gill, Winter, Hooker, and there are many more.
And resources like the Danvers Statement and the materials from CBE are great places to dive deeper into those different viewpoints.
So build your own little library on this topic, do your homework, and see where it leads you.
Excellent advice. And to end with a thought-provoking question, like Dr. Metters did. If Paul were alive today and he saw how we do church, how we think about gender, what do you think he would say? What would be the modern-day equivalent of these head-covering controversies? What are the things we do, the ways we present ourselves, that might send the wrong message? Or that might blur the lines between our faith and the surrounding culture. It's something to ponder for sure.
Definitely.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive, everyone. It's been a fascinating journey.
It has.